Listen to shoot the defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
So hello, happy Christmas Eve and welcome to a special edition of Shoot the Defense. I'm Mike Pieri and today I'm joined by an old friend of the show and someone who I've had the pleasure of interviewing before. A prolific author of Man United themed books. We last spoke back when his biography of Jimmy Murphy was published. Today I'll be discussing his latest book, which has also been made into a film. And the film accompanies the book and tells a story of a period in Man United's history which has remarkable parallels with modern times. It was a time of economic strife and turmoil in the country, suffering the consequences of an oil crisis which saw the UK economy decline and forced the then government to impose a three-day week. Recession, stagflation, the miners' strike and national debt rising. It was a grim time. This is the backdrop to an era that starts with Matt Busby relinquishing control of Man United, who were European champions in 1968, to the point where the club was relegated just 6 years later in 1974. The book and the film chart a story that to the modern post-92 fan would be unthinkable. With in-depth and exclusive interviews with people from the time, including Tommy Doherty, Sammy McElroy, Alex Stepney, Stuart Pearson, Lou Macari, Paddy Creran, Willie Morgan, Gordon Hill and others, a controversial part in the history of one of the world's most storied football clubs is laid bare in full detail. I'm an unashamed fan of my guest's work. This is another brilliant body of work and the film is superb too. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy again to talk to author and fellow Man United fan, Wayne Barton. Hello Wayne, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good, thank you Mike. How are you doing?
I'm good. Getting ready for Christmas.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction, by the way. So it's always more generous every time I come on, which is possibly one of the big reasons why I do.
Well, as I said, I'm a fan. And as I said in the intro, you know, we are going to discuss your new book, Too Good to Go Down. Before we go through the book, the obvious question to ask is, why this era of the club's history? I mean, most fans, especially of clubs considered big clubs, would see relegation as a dark time in their club's history, a time to actually forget. But you wrote a book about it. Why?
Yeah, I actually wrote the book on United's promotion season, the 74-75 campaign, and that was published for the 40th anniversary of that in 2015. And I was planning, after the Jimmy Murphy book, I was planning a book on the 26-year wait for a title. And obviously that encompassed the period that we're talking about. And when I'd actually done a lot of the research for it, I was contacted by Tom Boswell, director at BT Sport. He'd recently done the excellent Galazzo documentary. And he contacted me, he said that he was reading the 74-75 book. And effectively, you know, he wanted to know how could it be that United came to be relegated, because he was interested in the promotion season, but obviously the big interest for a non-United fan, or maybe even for some United fans, is how could it be that they got relegated in such, in like you said, a short space of time. Mm-hmm. So we got to talking on that, and I said that yes, there is a big intrigue in United going down, but possibly the biggest part in that story is that United went down, and although they were relegated in that period, the spring of them getting relegated was the time when Tommy Doherty had put together the skeleton of what would go on to be his great United side. You know, so they were already being reborn by the time they went down, and the idea came from there actually. And then, so when I was talking to Tom, I said, well, I've already been doing a lot of research on that period, so we could work on something together. He said he was interested in doing something that focused mainly on the relegation. Mm-hmm. And because I was spinning it, the Doherty era was much more than the relegation. Mm-hmm. That's how it came about, really. And,
okay.
So we did that sort of 10-year gap instead of the 26 years.
Right. I mean, that era, and you sort of alluded to it there, and certainly the season in Division 2 was fully embraced by United's, I guess, fabled support. Were you conscious to try and capture that feeling?
Absolutely. I mean, that's if you talk to any United fan who was, I guess we say fortunate enough, old enough to have witnessed that, they speak about it in such romantic terms, and it's, you know, that's possibly the one of the most romantic periods of United. You know, it's like a badge of honour for them to have been there. You know, but yes, like lots of us have seen all the title wins, the 13 title wins which followed in from 92-93, and they were great times. But for some of those time-served Reds, obviously that period is very romantic for them, because that was the start of the club being reborn. I know they went a little bit wayward after, you know, the Doherty period, but like I said, there is the romance there. It was very, very important for me to make sure that we got the feeling right of that. But that's where I think Tom and BT did an absolutely astounding job on the film, because it does transport you back. It's a real nostalgia trip, isn't it?
I agree. Why were both film and book launched almost simultaneously? Usually one follows the other. How come that came about? Was it just because of the collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was planning to write it anyway, the 26-year wait one. But when it became clear that this was going to be the thing that Tom wanted to work on, then it made sense to chop that book up into two anyway. Do you know, and it was getting that way anyway, because I mean, you've got so much. I know in the film we focus on the Doherty era, which, you know, is inevitable really, because of the size of the character. But obviously there's a lot of interest in the O'Farrell era, a lot of interest in the McGuinness era for fans like us, you know, a bit nerdish, like, who want to look back at that era and analyse what went wrong. So because, I mean, the McGuinness and O'Farrell eras are almost a book in themselves anyway, do you know what I mean? So it would have probably taken two books to do that. It just so happened, it was coincidental that it happened in that way. And you know, fortunate as well, because, I mean, the timing is just some, like you said about the parallels, timing, we couldn't have manipulated that to have happened the way they had. We started working on this in May. We had no idea. I mean, Mourinho might be famed for his third season implosions, but nobody could have seen the way they would go. And I mean, apart from the fact that we're talking about a modern transition and United have struggled anyway, the way that it sort of, almost to the day, you know, managing it. Like Mourinho got sacked one day away from O'Farrell getting sacked, and you know, it's strange, like things like that worked out. But yeah, it's the timing of it, very coincidental, but obviously very timely as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you are an author, so books are your thing. Talk to us about being involved in the film and with the film. How different is it? Because it's still art. What did you enjoy, and if anything, what did you dislike about the process?
It was very eye-opening the entire way through. So I've done interviews. Obviously, I've interviewed hundreds of people for different books. Mm-hmm. And most of these people I've interviewed before. Some of them I was fortunate enough to get a longer amount of time with, or people like Stuart Pearson, who I've never interviewed before. Mm-hmm. So those were the doors that BT opened, really. And I guess, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I just did the interviews as I normally would, try to get as much information as I can. Sort of revealing a little bit to the people who are listening and watch the film, I would be the person that the subjects would be talking to, so my head was just off screen.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So that's how involved I was on that. And obviously, I wrote the questions and worked on those with Tom and things like that. The interesting thing for me is that Tom, as the director, was obviously looking at different narratives and looking at the way that we would bring those bits to life and how we carried those through the different threads of the story, as opposed to me, where I wanted to get the bigger picture. And with a book, you can include every single thing and talk about the merits of all of those points that the different people make. Whereas for Tom, on a BT and a visual perspective, you're looking at the best parts of the story that are most compelling. Mm-hmm. As well as making sure that you don't leave anything significant out. So it's the art of storytelling, really, which was an eye-opener. I can't honestly say I didn't not enjoy any part of it. I loved every single second of it. It was a brilliant experience. And I wish I'd been involved more, but because I live in Manchester and I did a lot of travelling this year for work on other projects, mm-hmm. especially at that time, I wasn't able to actually get involved with the actual editing process, actually sitting there in the studio and doing that. I mean, Tom wanted me to get there and do that in London, but the timing just worked out. So I wish I'd been on that. Although, you know, I did see early advance cuts of the film and gave my feedback on that. And, you know, there's certain quotes or things that I didn't feel sat right in context, I would sort of advise on that. And because, so obviously, I mean, Tom's a Chelsea fan.
Yeah.
So he was relying on my knowledge of the history to know, of United, to know exactly what was relevant and what wasn't, and the key moments that might need further elaboration on. Or because there are a lot of those guys, like we said, they're getting on a little bit now, so perhaps some people have got drudges that have worn a bit longer than others, and you have to be careful of how much you indulge in their personal opinion and how far you strain away from the story that you want to tell. I think we got the right balance with that. But, you know, United, I've got so many, that period in particular, so many big names and so many interesting stories that by the time we saw the final cut, I was astounded by the amount of detail that they managed to get into 87 minutes. It was incredible, really. But yeah, I really enjoyed the entire process. And I've got to say, for anyone who's not seen it, Tom has done an exceptional job. And I'm sure that everyone who has seen it will agree with that, because he's direct and he's just absolutely out of this world. And he's got a massive future in front of him. He just did such a great job that as a United fan, I'm thankful for him for doing it in that way as well.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I watched it again this morning just so I can refresh myself, you know, prior to this interview. I mean, go back to the book. So you start the book by quickly dispelling the myth that post-68, the fall from, I guess, the ultimate club high of winning the European Cup, then was it simply down to the team getting too old and needed replacing, because this simply wasn't the case. I mean, George Best, for example, was only 22 years old, and many other players were still to reach their peak years. I mean, you allude to the fact that rather than the team aging, it may be the fact that Busby and Jimmy Murphy maybe hadn't adapted to the change in the game at the time, and maybe that triggered what was to follow. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I'm a loyal subject to Jimmy Murphy.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
I wouldn't say that on his behalf. Mm-hmm. I think that Jimmy still had a lot to give, and I actually attribute a lot of that demise in the post-retirement era of the fact that his advice and his experience wasn't used as much as it should have been. But these are sort of modern contemporary parallels that we can draw. So when Wolf McGuinness was hired, he was a little bit reticent to seek the help of Matt Busby and of Jimmy Murphy. Both of these people were, you know, what he would perceive as his superiors at that time. And although Jimmy was kept on a little while as his assistant, he always felt, Wilf always felt like he couldn't ask him anything because it would seem weak. And that's understandable in the same way that, for example, David Moyes, when he came into United, mm-hmm. he brought in his own staff. There's nothing wrong with that as a straightforward idea, practice of management, because a lot of managers do that. It's just unfortunate in the way that it happened in that regard. But yeah, I think Busby was fueled by the desire to win for those lads in Munich, to win that European Cup, and that was his end game. Mm. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't a long term plan for him to build a dynasty, another great team. Like, you know, in the same way that Ferguson was just always driven to build another great team, and hopefully it would win again. I think Busby just wanted to get there, which in itself is an unbelievable triumph, and I'm not diluting that at all. It's understandable that because he was so damaged by what had happened in Munich that it took its emotional toll as well. I think Busby himself admitted that he was losing touch with the modern players, such as it was in that time. You know, the stardom of best wasn't anything that he was used to, so it was the right time for him to sort of get out of the game. I do think Jimmy could have been kept on for a while longer because his value was on the training pitch and keeping those feet on the ground, so to speak. And he already knew, obviously, he knew George quite well. I think George as well said that he attributed the biggest change in United for when Jimmy was marginalised. But you bring in different managers with different ideas, and you know, like you were saying, it's not necessarily that those players were old and over the hill, but you wait 1 or 2 years or 2 or 3 years and perhaps those players, the potential starts to not become realised, or those players who weren't old at the start of that transition are old and that you can no longer build a team around them. For example, Nobby Styles becomes 29 and he might have still been a great player, but you can't build the next great team around him. You have to plan for not being there. And those are the understandable things that come with football. I mean, we're going to see it now with De Gea and Martial, aren't we? You know, the next transition, what happens with them? And nobody's going to blame them if they don't want to hang around. And those were the same kind of problems we had then. And that's the thing about football and it being cyclical, that a lot of the problems do remain the same, and that's why you can draw these parallels. But United's problems were just as complicated then as they are now. Do you know, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't just down to the idea that George Best was always missing and that there was an ageing team that needs to be replaced. It was a lot more complicated than that.
So there were, I guess there were inherent equivalent aspects in both eras then and now. I mean, when Wilf McGuinness was appointed as Busby's successor, it wasn't actually with the title of manager, but instead chief coach. I mean, Busby's presence was an issue that would not go away. And it wasn't really a succession, was it?
No, and that's the unfortunate thing for Wilf. And I don't think that, by the way, I don't think that's anything that was a fault on Busby's behalf. Mm. It was simply the players who couldn't deal with receiving orders from someone who, with all due respect, wasn't as good a player as they were. And that is, I mean, as good as Charlton Law and Best were, and as good as Willie Morgan was, I mean, Willie Morgan said he spoke quite strongly against Wilf in the film, said he was antagonistic. I don't think he was. Well, maybe he was, but he was doing that to try and earn the respect. And it was so difficult for him because obviously he would have to, every player at some point in their career has to deal with the transition of being moved out of the team. They have to, that's part of football. Now, the players who Wilf was trying to move on weren't happy with it, obviously they weren't. And if Stepney was dropped, for example, Stepney went straight to Busby. He went straight to Busby because that's where the power was. And Busby didn't want to get involved, but these were his players, you know. These were guys that he spent a lot of time with. For example, when Bobby Charlton was upset when he was... I know you'll probably get onto O'Farrell in a moment, but they're exactly the same kind of problems for O'Farrell. Is that, you know... And Paddy Barclay, who, by the way, did an excellent job on the film, talking. It was absolutely fantastic, and I have so much respect for Paddy and his knowledge. He said exactly that, you know, that there's no greater enemy to a manager than a senior pro who can't see, you know, he disagrees that the end of his time is coming in the team because they're so disruptive. And that was the problem for Wilf, is that even Bobby admitted in the introduction to the film, you can hear him saying, you know, even he could have been dropped before the European Cup win. So he knew that change was inevitable. He knew that it should be coming. Now, Wilf saw that. He wanted to bring in a lot of top-name players, but he wasn't able to because of the, first of all, the player power at the club, and second of all, I guess that they didn't, the board didn't want to sanction those big money transfers, and he was left, he did a fairly decent job. I mean, I know it did slide away from a little bit, but he did get them to 3 semi-finals, do you know, and there's certainly a big what if to Wilf, if he'd have been backed properly and if Busby had sort of backed McGuinness's decisions rather than acted as an intermediary, for example, which was, again, it's an understandable thing for Busby to do, but if he'd had sort of backed McGuinness, and it might have been a different story, but that's the story with all transitions. This is why we're talking about it, isn't it? Like these understandable changes and these understandable differences of opinion, which have such a profound effect on the club.
I mean, McGuinness was actually, he was quite young as well, and he also had to contend with issues beyond football or beyond the football pitch. There was the irregular payments issue. I mean, the first match didn't even have programme notes from him. It was from Samat. And obviously George Best. Now, along with Busby's presence, because of Busby's presence, I can't say, but along with Busby's presence, he didn't really stand a chance, did he, to be his own man?
No, and that's it, isn't it? He wasn't able to do that. And that is the unfortunate thing. Like you said, all the projection was that, I mean, even the announcement of McGuinness getting the job was a big spread on Busby with McGuinness getting the side column. Do you know what I mean? It's which says it all for Wilf, and I've got a lot of time for Wilf. There's nobody in history that is more committed to Manchester United than him.
Yeah.
Even now, he absolutely loves that club. And even now, if you ask him anything about Busby, he regards Busby as the god of United.
Yeah.
And when I interviewed him for the Jimmy Murphy book, he was always keen to point out to me that Matt was the number one and Jimmy was number two.
Mm-hmm.
He emphasised that so greatly. So he, and that shows you the respect that Wilf had for Matt and still does have for Matt, even regardless of what went on. He probably understood Matt's difficulty, and it's a shame that nobody understood Wilf's difficulty as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. He could see the bigger picture. It was about the club more than him, wasn't it? That's what he saw.
He was sacrificial, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And, it's a big shame because we wouldn't have known. It could have gone a lot better. But I guess now it's just a lesson to be learned from, if indeed we have.
Yeah. I mean, Franco Farrell came in next as manager, and he came with a good reputation in it, and he started well. But after Christmas in 71, United lost 7 on the bounce, and the team would only win 5 more league games of the remaining 12. Was the job too big for him?
Great question, that, Mike. I can't come to a complete conclusion, a definite opinion on that. What I think was, he came in and, you know, when Ollie said the other day, managing great players is easy. I think that's an element of what O'Farrell felt, because he didn't make any changes straight away. He got the team playing good football, but he made a couple of tactical changes in there, like Alan Gowling, who was a good centre-forward. He moved him into midfield, and that was phasing out Paddy Crerand. And Paddy Crerand, who was more tenacious, more all-rounded midfield player, more defensively minded. Obviously, Nobby Styles was on the way out as well. So United didn't really have that defensive screen in midfield. Obviously, the defence was ageing as well, and those a couple of those players weren't good enough and they needed to be replaced. And for the first half of that season, for the first half of his first season, they were really good. They've played great football. Charlton, Law and Best were all, they were all on the pump. They were all playing as well as they ever had done. But they were winning games 5-2, 3-2, 4-2.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of goals being conceded. And eventually, when you aren't scoring those goals and you are starting to, you're still conceding those goals, that becomes the major issue. And I think O'Farrell naively thought that the defence might sort itself out. It never did. And then as soon as United started losing, the same issues which McGuinness faced came for O'Farrell. And O'Farrell had pretty much the same problem as McGuinness, and similar to David Moyes, if you remember. When the problems came for David Moyes, you had a massive issue where the likes of Ferdinand and Vidic weren't really interested in playing for him. They didn't want to know Moyes' training techniques or anything like that. They didn't want to know anything like, the Jagielka, the video and everything, the infamous Jagielka video. And everything like that. They don't have the same confidence in this manager who's dealt with with all due respect, lower level players and their techniques there, they don't think, well, they improve those players, they can improve me. They don't think like that. They think, I've achieved more than you ever will. And who are you to ask me? George Best in particular, because Bobby was coming to the end. Dennis Lowe, his knee problems were becoming worse. So George was feeling a lot of the responsibility on himself. And he wasn't interested. He even openly said that a few times, that he wasn't interested in playing in a struggling team because of all the responsibility that was on him. And O'Farrell, he made some big calls. Like, I think he dropped him. He dropped Best quite early on. He made a big show of doing that, and that backfired against him. He also did the way that he spoke as well. I mean, the first 6 months of, or the first 5 months of O'Farrell's reign, when everything was peachy, he was in the press often. Daily Mirror gave him a weekly column, and he was in there every week, and he was being given the tag of Britain's best football manager every single week. And he was saying, no, there's no need to change. These players need, they just need confidence and, you know, that sort of stuff. And he was being heralded for all this sort of stuff. And then when it was obvious that, you know, change was needed, first of all, O'Farrell took time off his column because he sort of retreated away from the press attention. But then when he did speak in the press, it was sort of like, oh yeah, but I've been looking at players for a long time. You think that I'm just looking now, which completely contradicted the things he'd earlier been saying. And that sort of undermined his position a little bit as well. The funny thing is, he brought in a couple of great players. He brought in Martin Buchan and he brought in Ian Storymoe. So he obviously had some idea of what he was doing, but then he brought in a lot of big name forwards who weren't very good. They weren't fit to list the forwards that they would be replacing, and that became a massive problem for O'Farrell, because bringing in players like Ted McDougall to replace the goals of Dennis Lowe, and those were the decisions that if United didn't pick their form around, turn the form around, he was going to be judged on pretty quickly, and you know that proved to be the case.
That's right. So, 16th of December 1972, away to Crystal Palace, and the host thumped United 5-0. You quote Alex Stepney, the way he recorded it, and he called it a, quote, dark day. And he also goes on to say, the laughter had gone out of the club, there was no spark, no enthusiasm. Was that a pivotal moment during this period for the club? Again, there are obvious parallels with what's gone on this last couple of weeks and what we've seen.
Yeah, I think so. That's probably the most powerful comparison you can make about the mood of the club then and now. But I also think that you could rewind a couple of years ago and have that. Because I don't think it's all on Jose Mourinho now. So if you go back to the winter of Louis van Gaal, his last season, and we were losing against, I think we'd lost something like 4 or 5 games in a row. We lost against Norwich, and Cameron Jerome looked fantastic. There was that famous game against Wolfsburg where we were eliminated in the Champions League, and Van Gaal brought on Powell for Mata or something like that. Massive, massive thing. And that around, the mood around the club at the time was very much like it is now, well, prior to Ole's arrival, and like it was a couple of years ago. And I guess you've got, they're all the same kind of reasons, you know, players who for a while thought that they were bigger than the club and that they could dictate. I mean, with all due respect to George Best, he was, I guess, if we're drawing those comparisons and those parallels, we are saying that he was effectively the Paul Pogba, aren't we? You know, Pogba has, this season, he's admitted a couple of times, you know, perhaps we didn't put the effort in. And I know there are a lot of people, like I said, who want to put all the blame at Mourinho's door. And I know we're talking more about the present than the past. But he did come out and say that. And that is probably the modern equivalent of George Best doing what he was doing in that period in the 70s. He wasn't interested at that time, actually. He was getting sacked. Best was getting sacked from the club as well because of his attitude. They got rid of Best and O'Farrell on the same day to try and get that clean sweep. So yeah, I mean, there was that. Perhaps it's more tangible now in the dressing room than what it was there, because you only had Wilf McGuinness only brought in here Ian Ewer, so there wasn't really that. He couldn't say that he changed the dressing room too much. He probably his reign had allowed the likes of Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law to allow their influence to be more prominent than what it would have been under Busby, you know, because those suddenly became the big guys. Those were the guys whose opinion really mattered. And the likes of David Sadler, who's a club legend, who sort of falls by the wayside in this story because he was one of those players who was moved on. You've got some great players in there who weren't prominently featured because of how it went for Charlton, Law and Best. And the side, I mean, they were all European players of the year, so it's got bounced that way. Obviously, O'Farrell then bring in a number of players, like four or five players. And by the time it got to, let's say, December, when that Palace game happened, you've got Martin Buchan, who's hopefully going to be the leader of that side, as it turned out to be. He was being named captain. I think he was named captain in his first game. So it was obviously, that's the idea for O'Farrell. He wanted him to be the leader in that defence, but he was the only one, the only new name in that defence. And also, he was quite reserved. And when he did speak, he spoke his mind, which, as you know, a new player in a defence that had won the European Cup, bound to ruffle a few feathers. And so there was a divided dressing room. Certainly, you know, those players that you got, like McDougall, Wyn Davies, Ian Storymore, players that, you know, they're decent players, but they just weren't at the calibre United needed. So there was going to be that divide in the dressing room, because those were all O'Farrell's men and those were the players that he was putting his faith in. And you might have the likes of a George Best or Dennis Law thinking, quite rightly, those aren't the calibre we need to get out of trouble. And that's why probably O'Farrell had, even though it was still a short spell in charge, 1.5 years, he probably had less grounds to argue his dismissal than McGuinness, because for about a year it was clear that he wasn't big enough to command United. I think that's probably where the idea of, you know, the kind of character a United manager needs to have, yeah. I think that's probably where it came in, because it became obvious that they needed a personality to deal with the media as well. I think Paddy Creran says it great in the film, doesn't he? Yeah. He came as a stranger and he left as a stranger.
Correct. And that's the O'Farrell period coming to an end. And next up was Tommy Docherty, the man who would actually be in charge when United were relegated. I was interested to read in the book about Willie Morgan's, you know, how instrumental he was in getting the Doc to the club. Can you just take us through that briefly?
Yeah, he was, they'd obviously worked together as Scotland. Tommy had been manager of Scotland for a brief period. They played in the mini World Cup, which was the prelude to the it was a 74 World Cup. They played in the mini World Cup together, and Tommy had done a great job revitalising and putting a lot of confidence into those Scotland players. They're looking really good, and there was a fairly decent Scottish contingent at Old Trafford as well. You had Dennis Law, Willie Morgan, and Paddy Creran, but more so the prior two, who were quite pally with Busby. And when it was obvious that a change was needed, those two, Law and Morgan in particular, gave glowing recommendations of Doherty to Busby. And then it was a case of Morgan gave Busby the phone number of Doherty, and within days, really, that change had been made. But I also think that it was also there at the Palace game, wasn't it, where Busby had bumped into... The funny thing was that Doherty turned up for that game. He didn't have a ticket. O'Farrell gave him a ticket, a complimentary pass to get into the ground. And you never know Yeah. Paul Farrell signed his own death warrant because like that, the change was made. It, and that's the thing that isn't mentioned in the film that I only found out about really doing the research for the book, is that Paul Farrell had given him the complimentary pass to get into that ground as well. And like it's said in the film, and everyone has mentioned that he's gone on record a few times, that they met at off time and then at full time, where Busby effectively off-docketed a job, and then it was a matter of getting his number, getting him sealed, you know, getting it over the line and making sure that everything was agreed with Scotland. And yeah, by the time the next game came around, Docherty was United's manager.
Well, you mentioned earlier that Dennis Law, one of United's Holy Trinity, you know, a European Footballer of the Year. So we're talking like a major legend of the club. But there was controversy surrounding his departure from the club, and Tommy Docherty's intertwined within that. Can you talk us briefly about that?
Yeah, Law wasn't, you know, he needed injections to get through games. He was a brilliant player, but it was obvious that he couldn't do what he once did because of the injury. The level that United needed him to as well. But also, in that period, in that 6 months, because United were so desperate, Law was also desperate as well. So, and that's the thing that's rarely mentioned, is that he was playing through the pain barrier. Even though he knew he wasn't fit, he was that keen to help that he was damaging himself in the pursuit of trying to help United. It wasn't just that, you know, he was injured and he was knackered and he was past it. It was that effort to try and help that he was putting himself at risk. And because he was putting himself at risk, he was no good to anyone. It was only when he obviously left and he didn't have that pressure anymore, he was able to sort of play something like nowhere near the player that everyone knew he could be or knew that he once was. But he still had a good season for Manchester City afterwards. But I think when he came to the end of it, he thought that he'd be getting another year on his contract. But I think he was quite prepared to have retired if Docherty had said, I don't think we're going to go anywhere with this, and you know, I think you should perhaps call it a day, but you'll always be welcome around the club, perhaps in a coaching capacity. But he didn't go like that. Docherty told him that he'd give him another year, and Lowe went away to Scotland in pre-season, and in the post-season, I should say, thinking that he would get another year. But in actual fact, Docherty had told the board that he recommended him to be free transferred. And that's what happened. And he found out, Dennis Law found out the day after he returned home, because it was on Sports, something on the Sports Channel on the Saturday day, which, you know, it isn't great that it happened that way. But as again, Paddy Barclay said, it was probably the right decision for the club because they needed to move forward. Do you know, those kind of situations are, you want them all to be resolved romantically so that Law would have possibly been retired there and then retained as a coach. But, you know, it didn't happen like that. And perhaps Docherty felt that he didn't need romance at that time. You know what I mean? United were in enough trouble without him staying loyal to the, you know, at that time he felt like there were people out to get him and he needed to put himself first, which is what he did. And you know, it was as terrible as it sounds, because I love Dennis Law, absolutely fantastic, and meeting him for the film, interviewing him for the film was one of the highlights of my entire life. But it probably was for the best for the club at that time.
Contrary to popular thinking, Dennis Law's backheeled goal in the Derby v City did not consign United to relegation. That wasn't the reason they got relegated. I mean, 11, I think it was 11 defeats by a single goal was probably what did it. In the film, and also through the book as well, Law's reaction to the goal, I think, is impressive. Now, you just said that you've spoken to him about it. Tell us how emotionally he feels about that.
Yeah, he's obviously, that's the biggest thing that... The first thing is that what a tremendous shame it is that possibly the deadliest finisher that Manchester United have ever had is, that's the first thing that people always think about.
You're right.
That's terrible. That's absolutely terrible, because, I mean, if you're talking about deadly strikers, we've got a modern comparison in Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Yep.
And I think Law was probably better than Van Nistelrooy because so it looked a little bit more mobile. But they said, you know, they both had similar knee problems as well, which might explain a lot because we saw what Van Nistelrooy was like after his knee injuries and how that affects his mobility. So maybe there's a comparison. But obviously, Law looks more versatile with his finishing. Like, he'd score bicycle kicks and stuff like that. It was a bit more flamboyant as well. So it's this idea that he's remembered for that is just ridiculous, especially when it's a fallacy.
Yes.
Do you know? That's a tragedy of this unbelievably gifted player who won the European Player of the Year, who is the only player at United to have two statues of him at the club.
Mm-hmm.
One on the forecourt and one in the Stretford End on the inside. And yeah, he's obviously, he is reluctant to talk about it. And, you know, he talked about it to us, which, I mean, to get what we did from him for the film was incredible. I also, in a way, I think he didn't mean to say that, you know. He was just saying, he was talking to us just like, well, you know what I mean? I could tell that he was so reluctant. He was still reluctant now. He's like, you know, the 5 seconds you see of him talking about it on the film are preceded by 30 to 40 seconds of him saying nothing after asking him the question about it, you know,
mm-hmm.
your memories of the day, and he'll just sit there because he doesn't want to talk about it, you know, and you can see why, because it's the fallacy, but B, because the reality is the cultural significance that goal has, and the visual recollection anybody has of Manchester United getting relegated, fallacy or not, is Dennis Law scoring a back heel against them.
Mm.
That's what we all remember. And if you were a Manchester City fan, you would hold on to that, you know. So, and if you were a Liverpool fan, you'd hold on to that because it's a massive thing to rub United's faces in, you know. So obviously that's going to stand because it was culturally significant in the way that it happened, and you can argue the fallacy all you like, but you can see why they argue that. It still rankles with him even now. I think he'd like for the record to be set straight, but the truth is that it never will, and we tried our best in the film, and all you can do is point out straight up that, you know, it didn't happen that way. But I don't think you can really alter that perception, can you? It's like, you know, all kind of fallacies, those modern fallacies of trying to persuade someone of the truth when there's a more convenient, a more juicy narrative, you know, that goes along with it. And then that is, like I said, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing. The biggest thing for me in that is what a shame it is that the 200-odd goals he scored for the club are a footnote at the side of this one goal that was just a throwaway, really. It wasn't a brilliant goal. It was an instinctive thing, which, I mean, did show his brilliance as a striker that he could do that because nobody thought of doing stuff like that in those days. But he did. It was his instinct. It was brilliant. And that's it. And that's what people want to talk to him about. I mean, what a shame that is. But
agreed.
Yeah. I was keen to remind him, you know, that we not all of us think like that. You
absolutely
know, most of us do think that it's a shame that he's reduced to that footnote. And I hope that, I mean, like you said, you were the first person to point out here that it is a fallacy. So hopefully that there are a few people who do come away from this. The next generation of supporters will have this reference to look back on and say, well, no, it didn't quite happen like that. And if that's the best thing that we can do for Dennis Law, then that will be an honour and a privilege to have been associated with that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Great point. So, reading the book, it seemed that relegation brought as much pity as it did gloating, and pretty much a diametrically opposite to what would happen in this day and age. You know, relegation for so many clubs is the beginning of a long downward spiral. But for United under Doherty, who, you know, incredible if we're comparing with the present day, was still the manager, it was a time for regeneration. The club was reset. And that season in the second division, to many, is as fondly remembered as any of Ferguson's glory years. In a sentence, can you tell us why that is? If it's possible to put it in a sentence.
Yeah, good one. Well, I just wrote 80,000 words for that.
I know you did.
So, I think it was the idea of a blank page. The idea that United was starting afresh. And the added into that, that they played so many new places, you know, that they'd never been to before. And so it gave all this idea of a regeneration happening. And that's why so many youngsters at that time who were like, you know, today's generation of older, wiser heads who have been there and seen it and done it. I think that's why. Because there is a tremendous romance in that. I mean, if you think about those fans going back and further 16 years, I hope that... This isn't the same sentence, by the way.
I know it isn't.
I'll sum it up in a sentence, but in a long sentence. But if United had been relegated in 58, not that they would have been because they were title chasing at the time. If they hadn't gone down... I'm not saying that 74 was a culmination of Munich, but because it certainly wasn't, United won titles and they won a European Cup in between. But there was that feeling, wasn't there? You know, that even then, I don't think 68 wasn't a fresh page after Munich. 68 was the end of everything they tried to do after Munich. 74 was like that was the blank page. That was a fresh start for the club. That was the beginning of the post-Busby era, wasn't it, really? That was the time when nothing from the Busby era remained, apart from Alex Stenner and Willie Morgan for a little while. And then United were, you know, they were up and they were flying. And I mean, the romance of, like, you know, going to places like Blackpool and York and Cardiff, and even though they were, you know, there was a lot of violence and stuff like that. But those are the things that kids 14 and 15 and 16 who were sneaking away to these away games, who were being able to travel to these away games for the first time. These are the things that they do remember fondly, you know. All teenagers kind of do. Remember, you know, the, I guess, for want of a better word, the ambience of an away game in British football of that time. And, you know, it was the hooligan era, as much as it was for the next 10, 15 years. You know, that was part of British culture, British football culture, so it was something that they will remember fondly, you know, and that was, for those people who were there at that blank page stage, it was, I think that's the big reason why,
Okay, excellent. United sealed promotion at the beginning of April in 75 with a 1-0 win at Southampton. Doherty had transformed the team, and many of the players he had playing in that team would go on to become cult heroes. Greenough, Koppel, McElroy, Lou Macari, Gordon Hill, Willie Morgan, and others. Now, you've interviewed many of them and written books about some of them for this and other books. Would it be unfair to ask you who your favourite is, or a favourite story amongst all that?
My favourite, I love Sammy McElroy. Keep pestering him to hopefully work with him on doing his book one day. Obviously, tremendous affection for Brian Greenough, who sadly passed. And by the way, without whom none of this would have happened, this film wouldn't have happened, because the 74-75 book was actually meant to be written with Brian as the front voice of that. It would have been told in his voice.
Wow.
With the other people. So that all came from Brian. And I, for my part, I dedicated the book and the film, this book and this film, to Brian. And Gordon Hill, I mean, what can I say about him? Probably the best player of that team. The who scores 25 goals from the wing, you know, and all of them great goals. Fantastic, prolific goal scorer. I said to him when we were doing the final edit of the film, I said, the last 10 minutes are like your personal I Like Collection is on that film. You know, it's great. So I've got such a fondness for those, and but also for Tommy, who, this character who's been maligned by the sound bites and the fact that the controversial circumstances in which he left the club. It was such a big reason of me doing this, particularly when Tom was talking about the, you know, the how could it be that United got relegated. I saw it as an opportunity to restore the idea that Tommy was a great manager in United's history, because nobody ever thinks about that. Everyone thinks, you know, obviously Busby and Ferguson are the top of the tree, and obviously the argument is which one of those is the best, and what a great argument to have. But for me, sitting comfortably at number three is Tommy Docherty, and yeah, nobody should undervalue that, because it wasn't, you know, he built a great team, he built a fantastic team, possibly the most entertaining side that we've had, apart from, well, not even possibly for me, I think it's without question the most entertaining side we've had, apart from a Busby or Ferguson team. But also the work that he had to do, the nasty work that he had to do to get to that point, because nobody's ever done that before. We've seen Ferguson overtake a transition, and you know, the work that he did was unparalleled, as Busby's was in different circumstances. But nobody had to do that nasty transitional work what Docherty had to do.
No.
Which, you know, we've seen, I think we've seen Van Gaal and Mourinho having to do two people doing what Docherty did. Do you know what I mean? So the number of players that they had to oversee leaving the club was sort of similar to what Docherty had to do, which tells you the scale of the task that he had to do. So yeah, there are a lot of people that I think I've got a fondness for. They're all legends.
Yeah.
Do you know? People think that, you know, they won an FA Cup, and that's it. So they're not, shouldn't be regarded as legends when you consider the trophy counts of some of the players. They were some of the best players we've ever had. And I'm telling you, if you go back, and I don't think it is just nostalgia, if you went and talked to any fan who was old enough to have seen that team, they would, if you said to a man, would you swap them for this side that we've got now, I think they would do it. And I don't think that that's to do with nostalgia. I think they were as good, better than this current team, which tells you something of the potential that they had when Docherty sacked, because we never saw how good they could have been. Yeah, I think my favourite two would be Ryan and Gordon, just because I've worked so closely with them. You know, it's been so long that I've known both of them. But like I said, Tommy as well, because I mean, oh, what a guy! He's what a character he is even now at 90. Do you know, it's incredible, yeah.
That does come through. I mean, you know, Paddy Barclay, who's quite prominent in the film and in the book, you know, you quote a lot of from his work, and especially the Busby work. But, you know, he actually states how there's favourable comparisons and certain traits that Tommy Docherty has and to those that are admired in Sir Alex. There was also the style of football. Yeah, you know, when United got promoted, there was that positive experience of winning the Second Division Championship and the momentum that carried them through to the next campaign. It was substantial and real. Yes, there was a cup final defeat to Southampton in 76. Then what followed was the treble-busting defeat of Liverpool in 77. And there was great optimism that the Doc's young team were, you know, they were exciting to watch, as you said. But then he was gone. And you asked the question in your book, had Docherty stayed, what if? Now, having spoken to the players of that team, was there a genuine case of what might have been?
Yeah, certainly for the players. And I think 50% based in the reality, 50% based out of their own bias, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, look at the likes of a lot of these players, maybe. I mean, the average age of that side that beat Liverpool in 77 was the same as the average age of the fledgling side that beat Liverpool in 96.
Yeah.
And we all know what they went on to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the comparison is valid. And when you look at the likes of Brian Greenough, who was sold at 25 or 26, Gordon Hill, who was sold despite being top scorer from the wing, again with something like 25 goals, he was 22, 23. Do you know, they weren't even close to reaching their peak. They were nowhere near their peak. And then that, for me, it validates the what if. Now, the question is, you know, how high was that ceiling? So, Paddy Barclay said it was limitless, which I love that, because, I mean, it sort of sums it all up. And then you look at Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest, both teams who were in the second division with United. I know that Forest had Clough. But we're talking about, you know, the biggest club with the biggest resources. If they'd have allowed Doherty to spend the money, if they'd have given him the players he wanted to sign. Now, there's no guarantee.
No.
There never is. And you can't, you know, if I was speaking with guarantees, if I was sat here having a conversation with Sammy McBride and Gordon Hill, I would be fully indulgent in the idea that they would have won a First Division and won a European Cup. And I would fully vindicate that. I would talk about them and I'd say, yeah, you definitely would have done that. Clinically speaking, do I think that they would have done? I'm not too sure. They were probably two or three. If they weren't two or three players in the first team, sure. If we can say for argument's sake that their win over Liverpool meant that the first team was capable of beating Liverpool, then I still feel that that was the first team. And I don't think if they'd have lost one player, it might have had a profound effect. So if they had lost the Jimmy Greenough,
they might
have been completely destabilised. If they'd have lost Gordon Hill, where would those 20 goals come from the wing? If they'd have lost a Brian Greenough or a Martin Buchan in particular, where what would they have in centre of defence? You know, they were probably five or six squad players short of genuinely doing, but they could have got there. They could have easily got there. And by the way, that theory is proven by the following months after Dave Sexton came in charge, because so many players got injured and it completely derailed any hope they had of winning anything that season. But we're talking about romance, aren't we? That's the only, we're talking about, especially considering what they had done and what they had achieved in turning the club around, and the affection that the fans had for that particular group of players. Why not indulge in what the romance of saying what they could have done? Because we don't know what they could have done, so the least that they deserve is that romance.
Sure.
It's not quite the same as the Busby Babes side, who sadly perished, but it's another great what-if Manchester United side, and that's the least that they deserve, because they were broke up. We don't know what they would have achieved, so let's not devalue what they did do by saying that they wouldn't have gone on to have won these great trophies. They were certainly capable. They had the potential of being the team that would have ensured we wouldn't have been waiting for 26 years. Yeah. That's for sure. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
They certainly had the league title in them.
Okay. I want to ask you about Paddy Barclay. I mean, I was fortunate to have spent a couple of hours in his company earlier this year when he interviewed my dad for his biography on Busby. An incredibly knowledgeable man, and I know he's a devout Dundee fan, but is he a closet red?
No, do you know what? I think he could be, you know. I don't know. Yeah, I have to ask him. I'll certainly be sending, you know, funny you say that. I love that Busby book. That's one of my absolute favourite Busby book, United books. Certainly my favourite Busby book. And after I wrote the Jimmy book, I sent him a copy of it to see what he thought. And he reached out to me. He was very, very gracious. And so we actually did a podcast. I went to his house in London and we spent a couple of hours. So I was fortunate in that regard as well. And he was he's so knowledgeable about the game. And he was, yeah. And then that's the thing is that because he knows everything, he's such a good... Or it feels like he knows everything. Like so when we were talking, we did the podcast and it was only about Busby and Murphy. And we'd done that with, because it was before the FA Cup. And because it was 60 years after It was before the FA Cup final that we did it, because it was 60 years after Munich. It seemed like a really fitting thing to do, to talk about Busby and Murphy, considering that they got to the FA Cup final that season in 58. Mm. So we talked at length about, you know, the influences that Busby and Murphy had had and everything like that. It was absolutely fascinating, and not wanting to push anyone away from the Shoot the Defence podcast, but if anyone wants to listen to that, I think you can get it on YouTube, and if you want to ask me where it is, I'll point you to it on my Twitter feed. But yeah, well, it could be a closet red, couldn't it? Because he's such a fanatic of Busby, and the way that he spoke so glowingly of Tommy Docherty as well, and his biography of Ferguson is obviously one of the eminent ones as well. But yeah, perhaps he is. But I mean, he also wrote a great work on Herbert Chapman, the former Arsenal manager. Yeah. So just ask him which shade of red.
I mean, as I said, I mean, he because my dad was actually at the Arsenal match, the last match that the Busby Babes played in.
He told me about this. Yeah.
And I just sat there for 2 hours listening to two older men talking about football, and I was just in awe. It was great.
Wow.
And that's when the first thought I thought you know and like a lot about United's history. So I thought I'd ask you. You might have a better insight than me.
He might do. He might be a closet red. You never know. I think if you asked him on Twitter, he'd probably say it as an insult. I think it was an insult, but he's a bit divisive, and a lot of people don't really like his persona. But what an incredibly insightful guy! And by the way, if I haven't made it clear already, that the value that he adds to the film
massively
is tremendous. Yeah. I could have listened to him for the hour. He was fantastic.
Yeah, I can believe that. However United fans feel about the Docherty years, the season in the second division and the cult of those times, reading the book, I mean, I cannot help feeling that when the club was searching for, I guess, the right manager, they might have missed a trick. Why wasn't Brian Clough given the job? I mean, that could have been spectacular, couldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, great question again. Well, so we asked Martin Edwards, and this was never put on the it was never put on the film.
Mm.
But he actually said, he just said no straight up. He just said no. When asked, no questions, no discussion, just no.
Wow.
Why we can only speculate. A few people have sort of said, because we asked other people as well, and the idea was that he was his outspoken nature, which is ironic considering they went for Tommy Docherty.
Yeah.
But Docherty was never as... he was never perceived, despite them being as outspoken as each other, he was never perceived as someone who would be difficult to work with. And I think that they got the idea that Clough would be difficult to work with. I mean, yeah, we can say what an incredible manager he would have been. But there was also Jock Steen was Busby's favourite. Busby wanted him before they signed O'Farrell. Mm. You know, he was the one they wanted, so that could have gone very differently as well. You wonder, but you also think that Brian Clough possibly needed a Derby and a Nottingham Forest. He suits those kind of clubs, you know, the ones who were seen as the underdogs, because, you know, but you never know. It could have gone. We know what Ferguson was like. It could have been exactly the same as Ferguson at United, you know. Because obviously Ferguson went from Aberdeen, sure, the underdogs, yeah, in Scotland. He could have done exactly that. Clough could have done exactly that with United. Well, again, what a great what if. But I mean, you've got that for so many different characters, haven't you?
Absolutely.
You see, the idea that I think what makes it more tantalising is that Crerin was saying that Clough really wanted the United job. Do you know what I mean? Because then it's like, yeah, then you are given real cause to consider, aren't you, really?
Yeah. The film has been blessed with a lot of favourable reviews, and it's narrated by iconic poet and the so-called Bard of Salford, and he's also a long-time United fan, John Cooper Clarke. How did you get John involved? Or how did he become involved?
That's, That's all down to Tom, that. Right. We were looking at people who might be suitable for it. We had a couple of ideas in mind. I think they tested the waters with a couple. I don't think I'm really at liberty to divulge those names. I don't know if I'm allowed. But they tested the water with them. And then just one day, Tom reached out to me and he said, well, what do you think about... He actually asked me, he said, can you give me a list of celebrity United fans? So I found one, compiled it, put it together and sent it to him. And John was on that list.
Mm.
But he was just one of 50. Do you know what I mean? Ian Brown was on the list. I thought Ian Brown would be great. But so he was like sort of names of that era who fans would associate with. But then he said, what about John Cooper Clarke? And I thought about it for a little while. And because it is a bit of a left field one, it took a little while to sit on me. But then he sold it to me. He's like, just imagine like an old working man's club. You've gone back in time. And nobody's there, but John Cooper Clarke's there, and he's telling you the story. And he was like, yeah, how can it not be more perfect than that?
It fits. You know, it does. It really fits. It makes sense.
Yeah. And a lot of people, there's a couple of people who have reached out to him and said, oh, I'm not sure about that. But I was like, you just got to give it the chance, really. Because, I mean, like I said, the number of people who've been in favour of that particular decision far outweighs those who were... a little bit cautious about it. I thought it was perfect, and again, like Barclay, it enhances the experience of
it does
of watching the film. It is so good. And by the way, another one of those. You know, Dennis Lowe was an interview. It was the last interview we did, probably about maybe 6 weeks prior. Might have even been sooner than that prior to the wrapping of the film. We got in very late in the process, and that was like, obviously we're talking bucket list experience to work with and interview Dennis Lowe. John Cooper Clarke, as someone that I'm a creative writer as well as just a football writer, this guy's an idol of mine, and I would have never have thought writing a football book would firstly turn into a film and secondly present the opportunity to work with John Cooper Clarke. So they said when they were doing the filming, they did it at Moth Club in Hackney in London for the filming of that location. And Tom said, oh, are you going to come down and be there for the filming of that day? I was like, absolutely I am. So like, to go down and meet him as well as part of that is just incredible. And like, me and Tom wrote that script, his script together, you know, for John. Obviously, John added his own flavour to it and changed a few words, but we wrote the majority of it. And to hear him saying the things that we put together is a very, very surreal thing. I've got a massive smile on my face now, thinking about it. He's absolutely brilliant, yeah. And like I say, I can't speak highly enough of Tom for that decision. It absolutely just underlines what a great job he did. That's one of the many great decisions that he made.
Brilliant. Nearly there, Wayne. Last week, you did a book signing with Tommy Doherty. What does what does Tom make of United today? Did you get a chance to talk to him about it?
Yeah, I always try and get a little bit. We have a little bit of a joke of like, but it always seems to be that way whenever I talk to him, is that we're always in that little bit of a lull or a change where we need somebody like him to come in and do a shake-up. And, you know, he always talks about how much the game has changed and how difficult, because the club's almost unrecognisable from his time as well. But, you know, I think some of those things we've said about football being cyclical, about a lot of the problems remaining the same. There's no reason why somebody of him will play. All he's going to do that, you know, in terms of motivating the players and getting that momentum going. That's the point I've tried to make, is that it might be so simple, something like that. So Tommy, he doesn't really talk about that, really. But it's difficult too, because, I mean, particularly at the signing, there was a lot of older generation Reds who just want to thank him for the memories and talk to him about that. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So he's more in tune with talking about that sort of stuff. And obviously, he came to the screening of the film that we had in Manchester. But his wife, Mary, afterwards, Tommy's got a bit of a thicker skin, so we knew, okay. We said to him, like, you know, when we interviewed him, he was the first person we interviewed for the film. Mm-hmm. We said, obviously, we're going to have to interview some people who, you know, won't have 100% nice things to say about you, so just be aware that some of that stuff's going to go in the film. Obviously, the hope that we, well, the intention that we had was to paint the positive light on the work that he did do.
Yeah.
So we always made him and his wife, Mary, aware of that. So we were more conscious of Mary because Mary was more sensitive to it. So after the screening, Tom asked Mary what she thought, and she said, oh, she would let him know. But I don't know if she ever did let him know. So when we were at the signing, though, it was the first time I'd seen them since. I don't know if Tom had talked to Mary since. And I just asked them, you know, I was more keen to know what they thought about the film rather than, you know, their thoughts on United at the period. One thing I would say is that Tom has always said that, Tommy, I should say, has always said that it would be difficult for whoever came in to succeed Ferguson. And I put the idea to him when Mourinho was hired that they were similar characters in the way that they were outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
He rejected that. He rejected it, absolutely. What he said was, if Mourinho was made of chocolate, he'd eat himself. He rejected the comparison because of the style of football he played. I always thought that you would, because of Mourinho being an abrasive character and Doherty being an abrasive character, perhaps that's why he rejected the comparison a little bit, because they are like that. But I've seen the way that he's gone, and I'm always one of those. I'll never, you know, I may be a fairly stubborn kind of guy. I'll always withhold the right to, or maintain, keep the right to make sure that I can change my mind over certain things. And I think Tommy was proven right with that. I don't think they were the same kind of person. As much as I would have liked to think that they were, mm-hmm. I think there was a part of me thinking that as Tommy, partway in the second season, released his inhibitions and his caution and said, let's let this United team attack. I hoped that Mourinho would do that and change his own style a little bit. It never happened. And even though Mourinho ends up with critically more success than Doherty had in the way that he won a European trophy and a League Cup, so he won two trophies as opposed to Doherty's one, I still think there's no doubt that Doherty ranks above him in terms of historically successful United managers.
Yeah, I think fans would agree with you there. Finally, what's next for Wayne Barton? What are any new projects in the pipeline, Wayne?
Yeah, there's a few. I've got, obviously because of this, the book was meant to take in the 26-year wait. Yeah. I'm obviously looking at doing the rest of that period, so it'd be more like the 16 years. Obviously taking into account how close United came to winning the league under Doherty and how far away they really were, and the periods that followed that. So I'm already working on that. My idea is, and I guess it's as a good place to drop an exclusive as any, that I'm actually talking with a couple of film companies about getting that made into a film as well. There are a couple of other things I've got in the fire with regards possible adaptations of books I'm writing, but because they're still in the embryonic stage, I don't want to sort of say too much about that. It's fairly safe for me to do it with the other one because it was a book I'm planning to write, and I think the idea is now, if there's a way of translating that idea onto screen at the same time as writing something, there's no reason why I shouldn't try and do that with everything that I'm doing, especially the historical ones. If it brings something to life, for United fans, and seeing the way that people have engaged with it and the fun there is in working on it as well, I see no purpose in hiding away from that opportunity, really. The next thing I would probably say would be that that post Doherty up to 93 period, because everyone wants to know how that ends, don't they? They want to know how United came to win the title. We've talked about what went wrong. Let's talk about what went right.
Yeah. I bet Ron Atkinson can't wait.
Well, obviously he's top of the list in terms of people who want to talk to, but this is another person that I think history doesn't look back favourably on. They talk about him as just a cavalier guy who wasn't that football savvy, but they talk about it in the way that Ferguson inherited a mess, but he only inherited a mess because of the way that he went in the last year.
Yeah.
And let's be frank about this. Nearly every single managerial change in history, at least 90% of the time, more than that probably, they're getting a job because the previous manager left a mess.
Yeah.
No matter how successful it was in the intervening years. So you can say that about Ron Atkinson, but I also think he did a fantastic job as well. Played some amazing football. That's my first United side. Mm. And I love that. And the idea of finding out, you know, why United didn't win the league under him is a great thing. I mean, they had the opportunity, they had the talent, they've got players. Again, we're talking about fans of that era, which I know that you're included in, Mike. If I gave you the poser right now, to a man, if you would rather have that side in 1985 that won the FA Cup as opposed to the one that we've got now, I bet it wouldn't be an easy decision for you. I bet you'd have to go through that team one by one and think, you know what, maybe I'd have that 85 side now, you know.
Oh, Brian Robson over anyone in this era, definitely. Oh, Paul McGrath, wow. Norman Whiteside.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. And yeah. I think that, you know, we're fans of, that's our era.
Yeah.
You know, we've done a lot of, we've done a lot of digging, and like, you know, you have that interest in that era as well. That's why we're talking about that.
Yeah.
The era prior to us being born and prior to us having this kind of knowledge. So that is of interest to us, but of equal interest, which is going to be the next thing to tackle, is that era of us, our first memories of United.
Yeah.
We need to get into that and start shining that light a bit more positively on what they went through. I mean, yeah, we all know what went wrong. Let's start talking about what went right and how closely. Because if you look at the last two or three years, Atkinson's era at United is far more loyal to our identity as a football club than what the last 3 years have been. So, yeah.
Agreed. Sounds fascinating. Sounds brilliant. Can't wait. Wayne, that's it. Can I wish you a Merry Christmas? Thanks again for coming on the show. As always, it's been a pleasure. Do you want to give our listeners your Twitter handle or any websites that they can access some of your stuff?
Yep, Merry Christmas to you too, Mike, and all the people listening. Thank you. You do a great job on this podcast, mate. It's one of my absolute favourites. In fact, probably is my favourite podcast. I always make sure I catch it. I always love the discussions that you guys have. You're so knowledgeable about football, and it's an absolute pleasure to talk about the game with you and United.
Brilliant. Appreciate that.
You didn't pay me for that, by the way. That's all honest. It came from the far. My Twitter handle is Wayne S. Barton. If you want to catch any, I do most of my long form writing at a website, wearethebusbyboys.com. It's generally pretty long form, between 1,000 and 3,000 words. It's stuff that's not quite long enough to fit into a book, but makes good reading on a website. And on that website as well, there's loads and loads of stats. Like, we've got every reserve result going back to 1946, all the team sheets on there as well, you know, going back to probably the early 60s. We've got almost every team sheet on there, so it's a real labour of love on that. It's the kind of stuff, like I said, is the stuff that I can't really put into a book.
Mm.
I don't think it fits, but it's there. It's for free for everyone to go and have a read of it. Obviously, we do our own podcasts as well, which are always only about United.
Mm.
But yeah, I really appreciate the time to talk with you, Mike. And one final shout out for Tom Boswell, the director of the film, because I do want to make sure that every time we do talk about the film, that I'm giving him all the credit he deserves. I did say it earlier, but he's got such a great future, and even if you're a United fan listening to this and you're not interested in other clubs, give the other films a chance, what he's done. Galazzo, which is, I mean, for any, again, our age, Mike.
Yeah, that was great. I've seen that. Fantastic.
Growing up in the 90s and watching Channel 4's Galazzo and everything like that. And also, I think he did From Rocky to Wright, a great documentary about Roe Castle and Ian Wright. Just just great stuff. There's bound to be more coming from him. So yeah, just wanted to make sure that I dropped that one in there as well.
Brilliant. And before I go, I'd just like to say that the book and the film, for me, vividly capture a cult era in the history of Man United. And as is always the case with Wayne, the book is superbly written. The film too is fantastic. The interviews are insightful. The imagery used perfectly, as we've alluded to, well, as we've spoken about throughout this podcast. And the clips of the time really give a sense of being there. There are multiple repeats of it on BT Sport. And I would say to any fan of football, not just United fans, go and watch it. This has been Mike Pieri and you've been listening to Shooting the Defence. May I wish all our listeners a very Merry Christmas and a happy, healthy New Year. You can find us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. My Twitter is at Del Pieri. And until next time, goodbye.